This is the Sunday Times Politics Weekly, where we talk about the week's big political stories. I'm Mike Siluma. Thanks for joining us. First on our conversation this week will be an update on the state of the ongoing coalition negotiations. This as the political parties in the country are scrambling to form governments, especially in most of the major metropolitan councils. Of course, we have to talk about Eskom and its increasingly tough battle to keep the lights on following the resumption of load shedding this week.
This Econ is racist.
I've never ever been a spy.
Can the DBS bank loot?
The problem is that pinky.
I'll never subject myself to whiteness.
Order!
I'm listening.
Can you have consistency, Honorable Chair?
Corruption was an Olympic sport. They will always win gold.
This is not a shit.
Can you please come
the
in?
Of order.
Let's welcome now our guests for today's conversation. Once more, Professor William Gumede, who's associated with the School of Governance at the University of Witwatersrand, Khutazo Madisa, who is the Sunday Times politics reporter, and Sabelo Skiti, who is the Sunday Times investigative journalist. Welcome to the show, all of you. Let us start with you, Khutazo. Let us just very quickly give a bird's eye view of the state of play in the major metros of the coalition negotiations. Shall we start in Joburg?
In Joburg, there hasn't been much movement. I think we're still in the same position that we were last week when we had the discussion. The parties seem to be not finding each other. The Patriotic Alliance in Johannesburg, for instance, seem to have thwarted the plans by the Democratic Alliance to form a coalition of opposition parties to basically unseat the ANC. So Patriotic Alliance pulled out of those negotiations, meaning that coalition of oppositions will not be able to govern in Johannesburg since they do not meet the much-needed 136 seats in the Joburg Council to form a government. They are lacking there around 120, just around 120. So the DA, which seemed to have been most likely to govern, has those plans have collapsed. Same with the ANC, negotiations with the EFF have also collapsed, leaving them in the very same position as the DA. They also can't govern. But what we're hearing is that they're thinking of forming governments of minorities while they are continuing to talk.
Okay. And they've got how much longer to talk still? This is a few days we're talking.
Bromac, they have until Monday because the councils have to sit by Tuesday. So they have until Monday, but we believe that they are now done. Well, the ANC has just released a statement today on Thursday saying they've completed their negotiations with parties. They did not go into details around, you know, who they are giving what, where, and whether they'll be able to govern in certain areas. But they're saying they are done with those negotiations. We don't know what that means. But they are going to their National Executive Committee this week, starting tomorrow, where they are going to announce mayoral candidates and also debate or get an update, rather, from the coalition's negotiations team on the discussions that they've had and the agreements that they've come to with these political parties.
Mm. And in Tshwane, Pretoria, how do things stand there? Who are the major players there?
DA is likely to take Tshwane. They just need to go back to the table and have some sort of an agreement with Action SA. They have the numbers, they just need Action SA. Without Action SA, they won't be able to govern. Same with the ANC. And we understand that their discussions with the DA's discussions with the Action SA collapsed, so to speak, because the DA insisted on only engaging with Action SA on Tshwane, but Action SA wanted an engagement, an overarching engagement on all hung municipalities. But the DA wanted to avoid Johannesburg because we know Mashaba still wants to be the mayor there. So those discussions collapsed, and those were the discussions that were going to give us an indication of where Tshwane is. But yeah, so at the moment, there is no movement in terms of Tshwane as well. But I still believe the DA is most likely to govern there.
Ehuruleni, there was speculation that Zondile Masina might very well be coming back as, or might very well not be vacating the office, because it looked like there was going to be a deal struck between the ANC and the EFF. Is that still the kind of idea?
It's a very weird strategy that the ANC had come up with. They had heavily relied on the EFF. Remember, had they agreed with the EFF, they would easily govern in Johannesburg and Ekurhuleni. Easily. In Ekurhuleni, they wouldn't even need these other smaller parties. But now, those discussions with the EFF have collapsed, leaving Ekurhuleni in the very same precarious situation that they found themselves in last week. So I wouldn't advise Zondile Masina to keep his staff in the office as yet.
To relax.
They still have them to relax. He shouldn't be relaxing. He should, if he had packed his office, he should still keep those things in the boxes just for now. Just for now. But the ANC guys are saying, because they have a majority there, they'll just, make sure that they have they speak to parties like the IFP, ACDP, and other smaller parties that have numbers in there to form a coalition with several minority parties there. So the last option for them is to have a minority government where, you don't have a 50+1, but you still put up a mayor, you put up a speaker, you run the council, and then only when you need to pass budgets and elect, municipal managers or whatever big decision that the municipality will have to make, and only then reach out to these other smaller parties. So Masina, he's not out, but he's not in. Basically.
He's not in either. Now, I was fascinated by how things panned out in KZN between the ANC and the IFP, because initially the impression that was given was that the IFP wanted nothing to do with the ANC. So what brought about the change? Do we know that led to this agreement?
Mike, I've been looking at the developments there. And speaking to people in the ANC and the IFP, they're saying, well, the ones in the ANC are saying, we as the media did not report on what the IFP was saying accurately, and that the IFP has never said they're not going to work with the ANC. They just said that they're not going to go into a coalition with the ANC, and even now, they are not going to a coalition with the ANC. They're just leaving, or letting the ANC rather, govern where they have majority votes, and the ANC would in turn leave the IFP to govern where they have the majority. So they would not be challenging each other in KZN. So they're claiming that we and the media read all of that situation wrong, and that they've always had a good relationship with the IFP. However,
So the media collectively just misunderstood them.
Essentially, we cannot do our job. That's basically what they're saying. But when you have a look, when you go back to listen to that press briefing by Kabisa, the leader of the IFP, and you listen to the briefing again, was it yesterday? It is a U-turn. They had made it absolutely clear that they don't trust the ANC. They cannot work with them when people in the KZN have essentially rejected the ANC. But I mean, letting the ANC govern or not challenging them is itself a form of working with them. I mean, if they don't have a majority, how are they going to pass budgets if you're saying you will not be challenging them and you're not going to work with them? So we believe that the arrangement that the IFP will now have with the ANC in KZN will also apply in Johannesburg and Ekurhuleni. They've had those discussions, and we believe that the people who were part of the negotiations in KZN were also joined by the guys who are negotiating for Johannesburg and Ekurhuleni. And although the IFP former leader, Mangosuthu Buthelezi, has denied this, that the president was in any way involved. We have it on good authority that the two met on Tuesday or Monday. I can't remember properly, but they met, and that the president's involvement with the IFP, the former IFP leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi, is essentially what sealed the deal between the IFP and the ANC and led to the U-turn. So the IFP negotiations team meets with the ANC negotiations guys on Saturday, right? Yes, there are concessions that are made. They agree in principle. But we understand that there was a call to say, in order to cement this thing, the president would have to be involved. And that led to the meeting between the IFP, former leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi, and the current president, Cyril Ramaphosa. So Mangosuthu Buthelezi claims that that meeting was only meant to discuss, you know, how the throne contestation is happening at the Zulu royal house and whatnot. But that coincidence puts whatever he's saying, you know, in doubt, because I mean, you're in the middle of discussing coalitions. IFP needs ANC to cement and confirm some of the discussions that they've had or the agreements, and then at the same time you have this meeting which discusses the royal house that has absolutely nothing to do with the coalitions. I think that coincidence is it's very weird. So we have it on good authority that they did absolutely. We have it on good authority that it was discussed. And the president, we know him to be a great negotiator. We believe and we have been made aware that he's the one who essentially sealed the deal. Because immediately a day after they met, the IFP comes out and makes the announcement that they made that they'll be working with the IFP. They could have done that any other day. They could have made that announcement on Sunday, Monday, or whenever. But they made it, you know, a day after this meeting between the president and the former leader.
Okay, I think that let's bring in here Professor William Gumede. William, you've just heard the Khutazo just unpacking the state of affairs in the different key municipalities. These talks, would you say, you know, that are happening between the parties, are they really about the citizens and the voters, or are they about the benefit primarily of parties and their members?
Thank you. From where I'm sitting, it does appear that these talks of, to get his coalitions going are really based on the interests of parties rather than the interests of the local constituencies. So I do worry about the coalitions that will come out of this, whether they actually would be coalitions that will deliver at a local level because it is now focusing on getting, you know, the interests of parties, whether it is giving a party members a job here or a contract there or the mayoral position in return for something else. So it does seem like horse trading here, not on behalf of ordinary citizens, but horse trading on behalf of the party's interests.
Mm. And do you think that those kinds of coalitions will how stable will they be? Let me put it that way.
Now, you know, if you want to take the experience from 2016, similar, you know, horse trading happens based on the interests of parties. Now, you know, on those occasions, coalitions were unstable and it often collapsed. So the coalitions that really worked after 2016 were those that really were policy-based and policy-specific rather than party interests-specific. When I say interest, it means in terms of exchanging jobs, positions, contracts, and so on. So, I mean, to make a coalition sustainable, if one learned the lessons from 2016, is for parties really in coalitions to work out a deal based on policies and based on delivery. And then secondly, to make these deals public And then thirdly, to consult also with their own constituents thereafter, not only with their party leaders. I mean, the case here, KZN with Itakwini, clearly it seems that the President Ramaphosa was brought in to, you know, to seal the deal for that local coalition. But it would be more important that the ANC and the IFP go back to their own constituencies and tell them, why did they go into a coalition and what have they agreed on, and make that public so that their own constituencies can also hold them accountable. And of course, also the public and the media and civil society can hold them accountable. That really will make it sustainable.
Mm. Okay. Now, on that note of delivery, let's talk about the next story of the week that we have selected. That, of course, is Eskom. What is going on at Eskom? And I'd like to bring in now Sabelo Skichi, who's the Sunday Times investigative journalist. Sabelo, in Parliament, the Eskom team, we're talking to the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises, and they were at pains to argue that there is a plan. You know, both the CEO and the minister, Pravin Gordhan, said that there is a plan. You know, what is your reading of the thing? I mean, you've been following the goings on at Eskom for a long time, even before the crisis happened. Do you believe the story that there is a plan?
Good afternoon, Pramak, and good afternoon to the listeners and Prof. Kumede. You know, it's such an interesting question. You know, whenever someone asks us, you know, whether we believe, you know, all of what Eskom says. And I think just sticking to the plan itself, I think the plan that Eskom has right now, if you listen to not just what they said in Parliament yesterday, but what they've been saying, you know, this year, for instance, the only plan that there is at the moment, I believe, is that the plan is for renewables to come online. They are hoping that, especially with the recent announcement by the Department of Energy, that once renewables come, you will be in a position to stabilize the grid, and you will be in a position to push more aggressive maintenance of this problematic plant. You know, when you analyze everything else, I mean, when you look at particularly, I'm hoping at some point we'll get into the detail of some of these units and power stations. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at what they're saying about the planned maintenance that they're going to do over the weekend. There hasn't been a lot of focus on it. I know they insist that they've been doing maintenance, but if you look at the sort of amounts of breakdowns that we're seeing, and you look at the amounts of statements that they've been issuing, talking about delays in bringing units back, you can see that, you know, they are not at all to grips with the immediate problem. You know, in fact, I remember the Eskom spokesperson last week in one of the radio shows talking about the fact that there are no short-term solutions here, unfortunately. South Africans have to basically brace for load shedding for the next while. You know, so I think their thinking is around the, you know, the long term, bringing in that capacity that you'll be getting from, you know, solar and wind power and all these other renewable energies. And once you're in a position to do that, then you can actually put proper maintenance on the coal-fired, you know, generation fleet.
There seems to be a blame game that has arisen now. If you look at what the finance minister said about the CEO, yes, of Eskom on the weekend, the thing that the story that we reported on, if you look at what Pravin Gordhan has, yes, said, well, I'll go back to the specific things that he said when he was in, yes, in Parliament. But politically, what does that tell us as to what might happen? You know, are we not likely to lose focus? You know, when you've got, you know, the key players, you know, yeah, the finance minister, the public enterprises minister, the CEO even, yeah, blaming other people.
Yes. So, you know, for me, and I mean, this is something that I've sort of, you know, been sort of thinking and expressing over the last couple of months, is that one of the most unfortunate things about Eskom, and I think, you know, it's a pity because this is such a big problem, is that, number one, even the problems that you see inside the utility itself are being looked at through the lens of, a, you know, white CEO vis-a-vis what some have now realized are the imperatives of transformation and all of those things. You know, so whenever we talk about Eskom problems, ultimately Tereta's name comes up, you know, but we never discuss the power stations. For instance, we don't know how old Matimba, Krill, you know, all of these power stations are, because if we knew that, then we would be able to actually look into the detail of what is being said about the breakdowns. And I think you're quite correct. You know, those sort of political statements, and I think, I mean, in as much as I understand the frustration of the finance minister, and I understand that he was communicating a real frustration, but it also betrayed something that was worrying coming from a cabinet minister, you know, that seems to sort of lack an appreciation of just how deep the Eskom problem is. And, you know, it's quite simplistic, you know, for someone to sort of say, yes, you know, this guy has been given the most amount of leeway. If you listen to the argument that they're making, for instance. And I mean, there's certainly been news articles and information to back up the fact that at a certain point in the recent history of Eskom, maintenance wasn't done, you know. In fact, some of the money that was meant for maintenance was diverted, you know, to other, you know, problematic contracts like coal supply and those sort of things at Eskom. You know, so those are very real things, and they have a very real impact in engineering terms when you run a machine without necessarily looking after it. Mm-hmm. You know, it is bound to start failing. So the reality is that there is a, you know, much more than usual failure of this equipment during Andre Tereta's time. I think the most disappointing thing for me is that there doesn't seem to have been a exercise to actually pinpoint and troubleshoot what the actual problem is. So you hear Eskom come out 1 week and talk about the fact that, you know, it's a dead horse. The next week they'll come out and tell us that we can't procure fast enough. We need to talk directly to OEMs because, you know, everyone else is not giving us adequate sort of help. And then the next moment you'll hear them talk about, you know, people that are tweeting ahead of load shedding, you know, as if there's some dark forces, mm-hmm. That are conniving, yeah, with people inside the entity. So, you know, for me, it's a bit of a worry when you've got, you know, leadership that doesn't seem to have a handle or a proper diagnosis on the problem. And they rather, you know, want to play to the gallery and take part in this political sort of back and forth, you know, now trying to hint that treasury might be a problem.
Professor Kumete, Savelo points to what he says is a leadership that does not seem to have, that's not on top of the problem. These public spats, What do they do to public confidence in the leadership at Eskom?
I mean, the big thing really, which is very disappointing, as Savelo has pointed out, is that the ANC leadership do not understand the depth of the problem at Eskom, but also at other entities. So the problems that Eskom is facing now is the problems, of corruption, mismanagement, and cadre deployment in the past. Now, the way state-owned entities work, and infrastructure also, is once you run it down, when it's run down, it is very difficult to recover it. I mean, to transform a state-owned company that has been captured, it will take at least 5 years if one compares it to other state-owned companies. And that is if all of the issues are being addressed. I mean, just think about, you have to, one has to compare Eskom, for example, with Steinhoff. I mean, it is absolutely no way that Steinhoff, even as a private company, will have a better chance to quicker recover than Eskom as a state-owned company. Now, unfortunately, that is the reality. And that is why, of course, you know, often countries privatize in state-owned institutions. It's not always because of ideology. It is just because an entity has been destroyed in such a way that to try to renew it and build it up will take so long and so costly that it become easier to just to sell it off and give it to the private sector. The big problem really is for the CEO of Eskom, and it is also a problem with many other state-owned entities, is that he doesn't have the full political support to do a turnaround. And a turnaround he has to cut the costs in order to make this turnaround happen. Now there's a political opposition in the ANC to cut employees, because that is necessary now. Also, there is also political opposition to cut bonuses and salaries because there's a national union of mine workers linked to the ANC who will oppose it. So you can't do that. It's impossible. Then there's the contracts. There's also a cost issue. Ineffective, inefficient contracts, high-priced contracts. You can't do much about that either because either there is a transformation issue because people will say, well, these are black contracts. You can't do that because you're going to be anti-transformation. Or it is contracts by political capitalists close to the ANC. Can't touch it because, they will respond to him. Then there's the coal mafia, for example, linked to the ANC, funding the ANC. Can't touch there either. He's got an executive. Many of them are not fit for purpose to restructure. Can't do that much because they will run straight to the ANC, straight to the president, and create issues. So even there, he's locked. Even with his board, when you do a restructuring of an entity that is so deeply in trouble, you really have to have a fit-for-purpose board to help you, support you. You can't even do that. So he can't handpick his board either. And look, during this crisis, have you heard the board members saying anything? They've been quiet. Now they're supposed to support him. And that shows the weakness of the board because the board in the turnaround must support the CEO. The CEO doesn't need to speak in parliament or to the president. It is supposed to be the board who needs to defend the strategy of the CEO. So that's not happening. So I think in that context, he is really doing his best with no political support. So either at some point he will have to make a decision whether he will continue with trying to flog a dead horse without any political support. His career, making you himself very unpopular in the public because the public don't understand, whether he will quit early because of the no support.
So I'd like for you, as we wrap up, to come in here. Could it be that we have got, in part, we have got a structural problem in terms of how we're dealing with energy, because we've got the Minister of Energy, of Mineral Affairs and Energy, yeah. And then you've got the Minister of Public Enterprises,
yeah,
seemingly dealing with the same thing, but actually not talking.
Yeah. So I think this is part of the problem. It also exacerbates the sort of lack of the inertia that you see in Eskom, is the fact that you've got on the one hand, a Pravin Gordhan, Minister of Public Enterprises, who in some quarters is seen as quite polarizing without even having done anything. All he needs to do is to just be in a room.
To be there, to show his face.
And then, people immediately form on either side of him. And then you've got this powerful sort of like personality, so to speak, in terms of the wider ANC politics. And then you've got Gwede Mantashe, who is the Minister of Energy, who of course, whose politics and ideology sort of influence a lot of the decisions that he makes in that ministry. You would have listened to, for instance, his rebuffing of the renewable energy agenda. A lot of it is based in sort of his own political ideology and his beliefs on, if we do this, we'll be surrendering a key part of the economy, type of thing. That's how he sort of views this. So you've already got this, and then you've got a president like President Ramaphosa, who has been slow to sometimes be decisive on these things. So for me, it almost reminds me of, there was a critical point at which SAA, right after they started the business rescue, needed immediate cash, that would have seen the business rescue become a success. And it took forever for that to happen. And part of that was because of the different political contestations, at the level of the ANC. Pravin Gordhan literally had to go and try and wrestle a part of the money out of one of our DFIs to be able to at least ensure that the business rescue continues. But of course, we do know that at some point the rescue practitioners had to threaten liquidation because there just wasn't any follow through from the government. And I think a big part of that is the fact that you have some of these entities sitting in sort of mismatched government departments. So in the case of Eskom here,
You obviously now have got a CEO that talks directly to public enterprises, expecting that public enterprises will talk to the Department of Energy about their needs. And what you did see, for instance, is that Eskom was talking about, you know, the bringing on of private power, only in the newspapers talking about a need for it and that it needs to be done quickly. And of course, you know that the DMRE minister was sitting on this thing. Eventually it took the president, you know, coming in and sort of forcing this thing to actually happen. And of course, increasing the numbers. And then you had Eskom again coming out sort of publicly saying, you know, it's a great move. So you've almost got this Cold War. You know, between Eskom and a department that it should be reporting to, because everything that is tied to Eskom's future right now, even the renewables program and, you know, the emergency power, is something that is being done at some an administrative level at the Department of Energy, you know, but you seemingly don't have fluent communication between the two parties. In fact, you've got divergent views on just, you know, the most important sort of things that you would expect that they would agree upon to move forward.
Okay. Unfortunately, we seem to have run out of time. Hopefully, we'll be able to come back, Sabelo and Professor Gumede and Khotatso, to take this conversation forward, you know, because it's not one that's going to go away anytime soon. But we'd like to just thank our guests for this week's conversation, Professor William Gumede, Associate Professor at the School of Governance at the University of Witwatersrand, Khotatso Madisa, Sunday Times politics reporter, as well as Sabelo Sekhithi, who is the Sunday Times investigation journalist. And by the way, for a podcast of this conversation, you can go to iono.fm, Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or wherever you prefer to source your podcasts. Until next time, do remember to stay safe, sanitize, wear the mask, and avoid crowded places. I'm Mike Luma, signing off.